And I freely concede, I mean, I'm a dinosaur. We were mad, I mean, we're completely bonkers. It was hellishly dangerous. And the BBC's corporate ethos couldn't stand us.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Sir Roger Gale.
The young Roger Gale grew up in Poole in Dorset. My mother died when I was five. My father and I moved back in with my father's parents. And I went to boarding school at the age of five as a weekly boarder. So it was quite traumatic for a bit. Then my old man married again, a wonderful lady who I regarded entirely as my mother. And we had a funny little house on the edge of the lake in Poole Park, which was idyllic for a lad at that age, and there was no danger. I was able to get up and go running around the lake first thing in the morning and did, you know, on a regular basis. And from the boarding school, I then went to Hardy's School in Dorchester, which was a boarding grammar school. And I was very, very lucky indeed. I had the most wonderful housemaster, a guy called Joe Roberts, who made it his business to try to encourage kids to do things rather than not do them, and turn a blind eye to mischief if he possibly could. And there was an old Nissen hut, a wartime creation for some purpose, I know not what, in the grounds of the boarding house. And I asked Joe if I could have it. He said, yeah, fine. I told him I wanted to turn it into a theatre. So I scrounged some old railway sleepers and a thrown-out flooring of a church hall and some wartime blackout curtains and some bits and pieces of lighting, and I built a theatre. And we had our own theatre company. This is at the age of 13, 14, I suppose. And we put a play into the Dorchester Drama, Dorset Drama Festival, and we came first in the juvenile section. Has to be said, there was only one other entry, but nevertheless, we won. We didn't have even the apocryphal, tiny black-and-white television. We didn't have a television at all. My father had a record changer, I think it was called, one of those things that you put a pile of records on and they played the entire works of Beethoven one after the other. And we had a radio, old valve radio in the kitchen, which, yes, we listened to a lot. I can actually remember the very, very first broadcast I did was at Hardy School, Dorchester. It was about the Dorchester Bayeux Society, which was a twinning organisation, and they arrived, the BBC arrived with one of those vans that literally cut wax discs. And the very first recording I ever did was in extremely bad French, on a wax disc.
This is Bondurant Falling, the last remaining station. Early this morning, the Soviet...
But the radio played a huge amount of importance in my life. In fact, I've never forgotten, because it's one of those things that you don't forget. In 1956, when I was 13, the Russians invaded Hungary, which had been very briefly liberated by Imre Nagy. He was spirited away to Moscow and was never seen again. And we were sitting, my mother and I were sitting, listening to the wireless, and this agonized voice from Radio Free Hungary came out screaming, I mean literally screaming, "For God's sake, somebody help us, somebody help us, for God's sake, somebody help us.
Send us immediate aid in the form of parachute troops. For the sake of God and freedom, help Hungary."
And the great Western world sat by and did nothing. The United States did nothing. We did nothing. The Soviets took over again. And I took part in a fundraising exercise. I actually instigated the fundraising exercise to raise money for the refugees, to buy blankets and toys and clothes and whatever we could. That was an amazing radio experience, and also my first, I suppose, non-party political experience. Again, I was very lucky. There was an ex-RADA, a Royal Academy of Dramatic Art teacher, retired to Dorchester, who knew of my interest in theatre. And Joan helped me a lot. And I was going through some back A-level papers while taking a prep in the boarding house. And I saw an advert for the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And I applied. And I got an audition. And Joan coached me for the audition. And I got a place. And it was basically an acting course. I wanted to be an actor. But we had a very, very good professor who taught microphone technique. I was able to do theatre and was also able to do sound broadcasting. And that saw me in very good stead indeed later on. I went to Seaside Repertory Company at the New Marine Theatre, Lyme Regis. Completely knackering. We did it. Had a lot of fun doing it. And then I went back to London, back to drama school. And I did two plays, the Scottish play and Merchant of Venice at the Shaftesbury Theatre. And I got paid to kiss Kate O'Mara twice nightly. Kate O'Mara was one of the stars of Dynasty, eventually. But in those days, she was a jobbing actress as I was a jobbing actor.
What a delightful surprise. It's Caress now, darling. You remember how I always hated Cassandra.
And that came to an end. And an old chum from Guildhall, who was actually an opera singer, Patricia Atkins, she then was. She's now Dame Patricia Kitty. A fabulous voice. But Pat was at a loose end and acting as secretary to a guy called Chris Moore, who was the programme director of Radio Caroline. And Pat rang me up and said, ever thought about being a disc jockey? And I said, no, never. And she said, oh, well, that's a pity because you're making tapes for us tomorrow morning. Everybody knew there was a pirate radio station called Radio Caroline. And some people had even heard of Radio Atlanta. There were the two of them at the very, very beginning.
At 201 meters, you're in tune with the Bob Scott Show, Living, Loving, Happy Radio Atlanta, the ship that rocks the ocean.
I knew nothing about it at all. Not only that, I knew nothing about pop music, which very rapidly became apparent. But I went in to make these audition tapes. I went downstairs with a sound engineer called Jerry Duncan, who was lovely. I did this awful tape, and I took it back upstairs to Chris Moore, Canadian. He said, oh, that was terrible, babe. That was really bad. Could you go and have another try? I'm off for lunch.
Hello, and happy Easter to all of you. This is Christopher Moore with the first record program on Radio Caroline.
So Chris Moore went off for lunch. I went back downstairs. Jerry, bless him, said, well, he obviously wants you, so we better try and do a tape. And we literally did about 20 takes of me saying that was a record by the Beatles. He edited all the best bits together and sort of then copied it onto one tape so that it was just about bearable. I took it back upstairs to Chris Moore after lunch and he said, yeah, that wasn't really very good, but could you be on the Bob Monday? What did you earn last year? So I doubled it and told him. And he said, yeah, we can pay you that. Get out on the boat. Get it organised. That was, I think, the Thursday or Friday, a bank holiday weekend. I didn't even have a passport. I had to get a passport in very short order. Fortunately, I was in London. I was able to go down to Petit France and get one. And on Monday, bank holiday Monday, I was on a plane to the Isle of Man, taxi to Ramsey, then on the fishing boat out to Caroline North. By the evening, I was sitting in front of a microphone playing records.
Caroline, the sound of the nation. Caroline!
I had not a clue what I was doing. But you can't do, sometimes, 8 hours a day, if we were short, sometimes 8 hours a day broadcasting without learning. So from very bad, I got to quite bad. I loved it. I mean, it was one of the bigger boats. And it had engines, which meant that you could start the engines and you could turn it head into wind. So if it was really rough, you could actually steam into the wind and to some extent mitigate the roll. When it got really bad, we used to go onto tapes. There was a thing called Caroline Thumb. You started off by taping an old half crown onto the pickup head to really weight it. And you could practically watch the vinyl burning off under the needle, you know, because of the weight of the needle on the stylus. And then if that didn't work, you literally sort of track the pickup arm in with your thumb on, forcing it down into the record. I went out there back, August bank holiday, it was lovely. So the back end of the autumn was great. Did a programme called Showtime on Sunday afternoons, which nobody listened to. And we only had six records anyway, six show records. So I used to put on the side of a show record, go over the side for a swim, climb out, turn the record over and go back in the water again. We were mad. I mean, we were completely bonkers. It was hellishly dangerous. Noddy, who was an engineer, went up the top of the mast to sort out the aerial, which was in the process of breaking. That's 170 feet high above the deck. And the boat was swinging, I should think, 15 or 20 feet either side. And this guy was sitting with a spanner in his hand at the top of the mast with no safety harness, just doing it. We were completely bonkers, but it was great fun. Well, we knew we had an audience, although I'm not sure I did, but certainly the jocks who were popular had an audience because when we went ashore at Ramsey Isle of Man and we'd get on the fishing boat, the tender vessel, because the pirate ship was anchored outside the 3 mile limit. That was the whole point. It had to be outside the 3 mile limit. We'd say we're coming ashore. And by the time we'd got on the alongside the key to be checked by the customs. We had to go through customs every time we went ashore and show our passports. The whole quayside was just crammed with screaming girls, which, as you can imagine, for a young man was hell. That was Caroline North. Chris Moore then decided we had differences of opinion over what ought to be played. Ronan O'Reilly and Chris Moore decided they wanted, I think they had an interest in the ska, the Carnival record label, which played ska. Monday's tired, fair old face. Whoa, now, I knew not a lot about pop music, as I've indicated. I wasn't even a great fan of Merseybeat. I certainly wasn't a great fan of ska. Yeah, Petula Clark, Downtown, yes, but ska? So I demurred and declined to play this stuff, and I got fired by Chris Moore. So that was all right. I mean, I just went ashore and thought, well, you know, that's that job done, on to the next one. Got down south, got called into Caroline House, and the then new programme director for Caroline South said, come and be one of my good guys. Good guys? Oh yeah, he was a New Zealander, lovely guy. Anyway, we were the Caroline good guys. We all had to wear grey, light grey trousers and blazers and be sort of terribly mauled.
Presenting Caroline's Men of a New Breed.
Music, that's our middle name.
Jerry Super Layton.
Daffy Don Allen.
Baby Bob Stewart.
Mick loves it.
Tony the Prince.
Jerry King.
They're Caroline's Men of a New Breed. The men who make...
I think the whole idea, active. Ken's idea, was to create a brand image. Piggybacking, I suppose, a bit on the Beatles, but basically it was the mod period. It was to try to present something that was clean and decent and all things that the kids listening didn't want, of course, which is why they preferred the Rolling Stones to the Beatles in many cases. It was just an image thing. We had great fun. I mean, I did a Caroline party time one night, I remember. It was my birthday. It was August the 20th, 1960, whatever. And I got all the cars to come down to the seafront in Frinton, and then all the cars to come down the seafront in Clacton and flash the lights. And it was great fun. A blaze of light coming from Clacton, blaze of light coming from Frinton. Everybody thought it was tremendous. Only problem was half of shipping in the channel was trying to moor in Frinton High Street. And we got a very terse message from the Coast Guard the following day, saying, for God's sake, don't ever do that again. Caused chaos because nobody could see the shipping lights. Well, we didn't even think about it. We were just having fun. And I'd been on Caroline South for a bit, and along came the next programme director, as an Australian, and said, oh, I know how you feel, son. I've been sitting in the chair that you're sitting in my time. I said, yeah, well, just for the record, as programme director, six people have sat in the chair you're sitting in the last 12 months. Anyway, that was that.
All right, now, everybody move to the whiplash. I'm holding the whip, you move. That's the way, baby, move it.
One day, I remember, the Radio London boys ran out of bread or sugar or something and sent a message across saying, if you're listening, have you got any sugar we can borrow? So we got the boat out and rowed across. The Galaxy was not very far away, so we got the boat out and we rowed across. And Kenny jumped off the Galaxy's deck into the sea and sort of literally halfway down said, by the way, I can't swim. And we're sort of bobbing off down the tide towards Harwich. We had to go and rescue him. Well, we were great friends. It wasn't wasn't competitive in that sense. So it was a brother bond because we were all on the wrong side of the blanket, I suppose. You know, we were not respectable, which was part of the charm. It was just good fun. It was clean fun too, actually. The boats from Margate, oddly enough, the parliamentary constituency that I now represent, the pleasure boats from Margate used to come across the Thames estuary, and we were like monkeys in a zoo. The pleasure boats used to go round us, you know, there we, and we'd all wave. Every now and again, one of us would dive in and swim across to a pleasure boat and say hello to the girls and have a glass of wine or something and swim back again. It was just fun. It was clean fun too. There were no drugs. We smoked. We got free cigarettes. We had beer, but we didn't have any we didn't have spirits. Drugs weren't even heard of, really. Certainly not on the boats, not that I'm aware of. I don't think it was anything unpleasant. And we were outside the 3-mile limit, except for the one occasion when there was a monumental storm up north. And Caroline North dragged her anchor. She had massive, huge anchors, deep-sea anchors, that were designed to keep her there forever. And she dragged her anchor inshore. And the Coast Guard used to have a drawing pin on his window, lined up with the top of the mast, and he knew that if the mast lined up with the drawing pin, we were outside the 3-mile limit. And he came in the morning, and the boat was sort of miles up the window. So he got his boat out, his own cutter, and came out, hit the point of Ramsey, realised that it was actually blowing a complete hooligan. It was practically a full hurricane. Turned around, went back in. Our skipper got the engines going, dragged the anchor behind us, and we were outside the 3-mile limit by the time the Coast Guard got out again. So the captain and the Coast Guard had a drink and he went home.
Dance. 9 minutes after 10 o'clock on party time. This is Roger Gale. All right, you want to dance?
My wife at the time, I'd married a young lady I was at drama school with, which wasn't the cleverest thing to do, but she was lovely and she still is lovely. I mean, she was a very talented girl, but we just got married too young. She was playing Eliza in My Fair Lady and was having a bit of a hard time with her throat. So I looked after her for a few weeks. And then Radio Scotland got in touch with me and said, we need jocks for Radio Scotland. This was the pirate Radio Scotland. I listened to what they had to say and said, you don't need a jock, you need a programme director. And they said, oh, do we? What are they? So I told them what a programme director was, insofar as I knew anything about it. And I was hired as the programme director for Radio Scotland. So I went up to Glasgow, got the team of jocks together, and put the station on air. We were supposed to go on air at midnight on New Year's Eve, well, just before midnight, with a tape from Tommy Shields, who was the chief executive, I suppose. Scottish showbiz, personality, television, whatever.
This is a proud moment for me, and indeed for all of us here. For after many months of trial and tribulation, Radio Scotland is now a floating reality.
The boat arrived late, as they always did. We were nothing like ready. I said to the radio engineer, can we turn on? He said, well, I haven't tested the transmitters. We have no limiter. You could blow the whole thing up. And I said, well, we're here to broadcast at midnight. Give it a go. There are those that will tell you either otherwise, but mine was the first voice on Radio Scotland. And Tommy Shields never forgave me for the fact that the first voice on Radio Scotland was actually English. He wanted, obviously, wanted it to be Scottish. Well, I understand why. It was my fault. I just wanted to get the show on the road. And I spent, I think we were up from 6 o'clock in the morning on December the 30th to about 4 o'clock in the morning on January the 3rd or something, virtually with no sleep at all. None of the other guys had used this kit at all, so I was in the happy position of trying to train them while broadcasting. They were a good bunch, nice people. And it has to be said again, you know, most of them were much better jocks than I was. But I was the team leader and I got the thing on the road. And then we blew the relays out and the station was off air and I went back ashore. Got fired again by Tommy Shields because I dared to say that things had gone wrong, and things had gone wrong, but we weren't supposed to say that.
On 242 metres in the medium wave band, this is Radio Scotland.
Stuart Henry, until he died, was well known. And the irony was, Stuart, bless him, who was an actor, and a good one, and was also a very keen fisherman, was seasick. And he lasted about 48 hours. And Stuart became probably better known than any of the jocks on air, because he was the face of Radio Scotland on land. He went round and did all the gigs. And when that pole packed up, he then went back to his first love, which was fishing, and I think made fishing programmes for Scottish television until finally, and very prematurely, he died.
I'm for you, I'm Radio Scotland calling you. Down about the Radio Scotland station, then I'm 242.
The Comet, which was Radio Scotland, was a converted lightship. It didn't look too bad because it had had originally, obviously, the light on top. It was sort of built to have a weight on top. So 170 feet of tubular aluminium wasn't too bad. I then went down to Scarborough and put Radio 270 on air. That was off the Yorkshire coast. 270 was a converted deep-sea trawler, wholly unsuited, really, in all honesty, to the task. She was fitted out in a hurry, and again we put her on air late. We made a sort of a deadline, but the boat arrived late, untested as usual. The team untested as usual, though Pete Berman was there, and he had done Radio Scotland, so he knew what he was doing.
A month of nights, a year of days, October's drifting into May.
It was run by a guy called Wolf Proudfoot, who subsequently became a, I think he was a butcher or something, but he subsequently became a Tory Member of Parliament, fleetingly. and a wrestling promoter called Don Robinson, who also used to wrestle himself as Dr. Death. We had these crazy sessions where I would go around and MC wrestling matches. When they didn't have an MC, I was required to put on a dinner jacket and go and MC wrestling matches. Now, if I knew nothing about broadcasting, I knew less than nothing about wrestling. Anyway, Don was a wrestling promoter and he had money in 270. I'm still vaguely in touch with him.
A month of nights, a year of days.
But I was hired to do the same job, to get the station on air and to put together some sort of programme, which I did. Paul Burnett was on 270. What I wanted to do, I wanted to create an easy listening station, really. I was wrong, because I didn't know enough about music, but the demand was for Top 40 format, as it became known, which was the success of Radio London. And they got it right, because they knew what they were doing. They were pros, and I wasn't. I was a happy amateur who was an actor turned broadcaster, pretending to be a disc jockey. Out of London, I thought that the easy listening format with different kinds of music for different times of day would work. So you'd have your sort of breakfast program with fairly upbeat music to get people to work, and then you'd have your housewife's music from, terribly chauvinist now, of course, but you know, politically incorrect, but nevertheless, the housewife's music from sort of 9 o'clock until midday, and then you'd go heavy rock and pop and stuff again in the evening. You can make a case for that, and there's certainly a demand for it. I think the problem was it was hybrid. And the radio, the Top 40 format worked because everybody knew where they were, what they were tuning into, what they were going to get all day, every day. Same Top 40 records, and then some golden oldens. And there's no doubt that worked. Okay, yeah, maybe I was wrong. I was hardly on at all. I played the first record. There are those that will tell you otherwise again and claim they played the first record, but I played the first record. And it was a record called Wild Thing by the Troggs. And the reason it was Wild Thing is because the Don Robinson's secretary, who was a very pretty lass, was called Jane Wilde. And we played that for her as the first record on the station. We were out there for about 3 days. And again, we had one hell of a storm, and it really was. It was a complete hooligan North Sea storm. And we were in serious trouble. I went up, I don't know, I guess about 9 o'clock in the morning. All the fish hatches, where they shoveled the fish down into the fish holds, had all been welded down, bar two, one right in the stern for the engines and one right in the bow to get access to the galley and the sleeping quarters and the studios. And there was no other way out of that ship. We had about, I can't remember, 15, 20 people on board. I went up on deck to get some fresh air because it stank down there. People were being sick and it was not pleasant at all. And I watched, and this mast, because they were cheapskates, normally you had 170 feet of tubular aluminium. This one was the top 50 or 60 feet, I suppose, was from an America's Cup contender called Scepter, welded onto the bottom bit. And because they rigged it too fast and because they tightened the rigging down too tight, so there was no flexibility in the rigging, come the storm, it buckled because it couldn't bend. And the top 60, 70 feet, whatever it was, it lifted off completely and went over the side. Then, of course, you've got all of this aluminium filled with water, still tied to the ship with the metal rigging, the wire hawsers, dragging the boat over. And she was damn nearly on her side. I reckon another couple of feet. And all the boys down below would have lost their lives because she'd have just filled up and gone down and nobody could have got them out. There was no way out. There were three of us on deck. The captain's son, I think, lost a finger when the mast came down because he had his hand on the rail. He was knee-deep in blood. And we just grabbed the fire axes and spent a couple of hours hacking the damn thing loose and dropped it over the side. Bill Pashby, who was a lovely, lovely man, he was the commodore of the Scarborough Fishing Fleet, and there was a proper Scarborough Fishing Fleet in those days. Bill, in his fishing boat, he was one of the directors of 270, he was lying off probably half a mile. No way could they get alongside. It was far, far too rough. And all Bill could do, bless him, he was a very brave man, but all he could do was sit and watch. We cut the rigging loose, cut the mast loose, dropped it over the side. At that point, the boat came back upright again, because the weight had gone, obviously. And then the storm abated a bit, and Bill got alongside and got us all off, and the boat was towed in. And then I got a bollocking from Wilf Proudfoot for not putting a marker down with the mast, not tying a buoy onto it, so they could find it again, because it was worth a lot of money because it was aluminium. I said, well, frankly, chum, I was more interested in saving our lives and the lives of the people down below than worrying about your mast. I could say, we were trailblazers, we changed the face of broadcasting, which of course we did. Did we know we were doing it? Well, somebody may have done, we didn't. We knew we were different. Everybody told us we were different. We knew we were on the margins of the law, but we were inside the law. We knew we were doing young, fresh, exciting things. But apart from Harold Wilson trying to shut us down, which we objected to because we didn't want to be shut down, I think Ronan O'Reilly was very politically aware from an Irish Republican point of view. Don't think we were, really. Don't think we cared. Anyway, that was that. So then I went back to London and became an actor. And I had a facility for dialects, as it happened. I can't do many of them now, but I used to be able to do practically anything except Geordie. I could never manage Geordie, but I did everything else. That made me a dead ringer for radio drama. And I did a lot of radio drama and had a wonderful time doing it. Love radio, because the beauty of radio is you can be anything, anywhere, and it's up to the audience's imagination. You say, we're walking on the moon, you're walking on the moon. I did that, and then did a couple of Shakespeare's at the Mermaid Theatre. Must have been early 1970s, very early 1970s, because then I'd remarried and I had a daughter on the way. And no real visible means of support. And I decided that the time had come when I actually had to grow up and earn a living. So I went off to the BBC to apply for a station assistance job at Radio London. I went for the interview and was told I had far too much experience because I'd run radio stations, you know. I'd be bored. I said, Hank, I need a job. You know, I'm not worried about my experience. I just want a job. And Alan Rogers, who was the deputy station manager for BBC Radio London, who was creative in his thinking, rang me up and said, Roger, you haven't got the job. They've said you're too experienced. Why don't you come and be a freelance reporter? I had no idea what it meant. I said, yeah, all right, fine. Will it pay me? Yeah, it'll pay you if you work hard. So I went, and again, I got very, very lucky. I did the breakfast programme with a chap called Laurie Mayer, who was the presenter, became a very, very great friend, and a chap called Vin Bootle, who'd been a journalist on the Newcastle Chronicle. Before that, at some point, he was the editor of Coal News as well. Vin taught me radio journalism. The only training I got, I went for a one-day course. Alan Rogers sent me to Broadcasting House Training Unit, and they said, this is a ewer, thing about the size of an old-fashioned radio. This is the on-off switch. Here is an editing block and a razor blade. This is how you edit tape. Go away and be a broadcaster. And that was it. I mean, it was one day.
You're listening to BBC Radio London, broadcasting on 95.3 VHF.
The very first interview, they sent me off, poor girl, to interview Britain's first female truck driver, who lived in a bedsitter somewhere in North London. So I schlopped out to this place. And this poor girl, who was large, shall we say, charitably, and I sat on this tiny little single bed, and I interviewed her about what it was like being a truck driver. And she was sweet. She was a lovely, lovely girl, but she was pretty monosyllabic, so it was not the greatest interview.
As Prime Minister, I want to speak to you simply and plainly about the grave emergency now facing our country.
1973, this would have been. I know exactly when it was, because we went through the elections, the 1974 elections, but we went through the winter of discontent first, and all the blackouts, and I got a job on Network doing the fill-ins for Radio 4 Today, saying what the power position was and when the cuts would be, when there would be no gas, no electricity, no whatever in London. And others did it around the country. And then as it wound down, they let me do the whole lot. And it was all worth money. And I became the station's highest earning freelance, which, if you were working hard, wasn't very difficult. Life was good. It was a great team. The breakfast team was super. Laurie Mayer was a very, very good presenter, had a lovely voice. And it is funny. I mean, Vin tried me out. He said, look, Laurie's going on holiday. You can do it for a fortnight. You can present the breakfast show. Oh, great, you know. Breakthrough. Wonderful. I haven't got the voice for it. My voice is fine for news, but it's not friendly. I can do hard news, fine. I just haven't got the come-to-bed voice that people like Laurie Mayer have got and Tony Blackburn's got and the people who are really good at it. I'm just not that kind of broadcaster. and it didn't work. I went back to reporting, which I was happy with. But it was a lovely team. And what would happen is they would come off air at 9 o'clock, I suppose. We'd go over to a cafe in Hanover Square, which is where Radio London was based in those days. And we'd have breakfast. We'd all have breakfast together. So I would go in to start my shift where they were coming off. So we'd do a wash-up and discuss what Vin wanted for the following day, what stories we thought were coming up. And then my job, and it really was, it was an editorial role, effectively, because my job was to monitor everything that was coming in through the day while Vin and Laurie were sleeping and make sure that it was covered. And if I thought there was a good story, I literally, as well as metaphorically, got on my bike and went and did it. Because I was a freelance, and because I was free range, and because I had a very, very creative, understanding editorial team in Laurie and Vin, who just let me have my head and kick my ass if I got it wrong, it really wasn't like working for the BBC, which made me a dead ringer again for Radio 1 Newsbeat. And when Alan Rogers, it was very funny, Alan Rogers went off to become head of Current Affairs magazine programmes for the BBC, for Network, and asked me if I would go apply for a job as a producer on this new programme he was setting up called Newsbeat on Radio 1, sort of Radio Sun as it became known. I wasn't sure because I was earning a lot of money with Radio London, and I was big fish in a small pond and doing rather well, keeping my head financially above water, bought a maisonette and was feeding my baby. And Alan said, oh, go on, put in for it. So I did. I bumped into him in the street and he said, well, what happened? I said, oh, I got turned down. They didn't give me an interview. Alan was absolutely furious. He said, what? But I asked for you. I said, well, sorry, I didn't get an interview. So he went away and he discovered that none of the people that he wanted had been interviewed or been offered an interview because we weren't BBC people. Well, of course, he didn't want BBC people. He wanted cowboys. He wanted people who were going to be the Wild West of news for Radio 1, not a cheap cardboard replica of Radio 4 or whatever. So he reorganised, he scrapped the entire board and started again, and I got taken on as a contract producer with a girl called Caroline Schindler, who was very good. Great editor, a great deputy editor, Colin Adams, who'd come from Radio Humberside, and he'd done all the Cod War stuff. Very, very good. Very good journalist, very good radio editor. And then Mike Cheney, who'd worked on The Stone at The Sun, had umpteen children. He had two jobs. He edited the Today programme on Radio 4 while editing The Stone at The Sun, doing his job at The Sun. And they brought Mike in. And the combination, politically, apart from the else, was very interesting, because Mike was a Marxist and looked like Karl Marx. A huge beard, he was a big man. Colin was a Liverpudlian socialist, and Caroline and I were both Tories. And I can honestly say that in the entire time that we all worked together, our personal politics never, ever interfered with our editorial judgment. And it's a very proud claim, because it didn't. We just got on and we did the job.
Apparently, the trouble's all down to the year 1970. What happened then? Well, in the southeast, at any rate, average pay for the year topped £1,900. And if the Building Society manager knew you were getting that, he'd probably give you a 90% mortgage on an average semi.
Make news interesting for young people. So bite-sized chunks. Colin was brilliant in his understanding that radio was about noise, which is why Radio 4 and the radio, the BBC corporate ethos, couldn't stand us when we started. It was during the Patty Hearst days, when Patty Hearst was kidnapped or whatever on the west coast of America.
You know, they knock on the door, and the next thing I know, there's a kidnapping, you know, and people are being beaten up.
And I was ringing up American radio stations and getting actuality pumped across a crackly telephone line from the United States and broadcasting it. And we were being told, you can't do that, you can't use, it's not broadcast quality. I said, the hell, it's not broadcast quality. It's exciting, and it's sound, and it's news, and we're putting it out, and we did. And we did a lot of stuff on the telephone in the days when it was carbon microphones, when they were crackly, you know, they weren't like today. A digital telephone signal is pretty broadcastable in those days. A lot of it was fairly marginal, but if it was good and if it was newsworthy, we asked the audience to bear with us, and we did it. We did some terrifying stuff. I sent Steve Bradshaw down to cover the London Underground crash when a driver drove a train deliberately into the buffers. The moment we heard on the flash, on PA, Press Association flash, that had happened, I said to Steve Bradshaw, who was, again, a great reporter and very, very courageous, very tough, I said to Steve, go, And he grabbed his ewer and he went, and he got down onto the train before the security services had closed it off. This was before terrorism and all that. This wasn't the bombings. This was just somebody who'd committed suicide driving a train full of rush hour passengers into the buffers, literally. Steve came back, he was shell-shocked. He said, it's like hell on overtime down there. The people screaming, and it was black, of course, and the emergency. But Steve came back with some of the most harrowing... I had to listen to it and edit it physically, cut the tape with a razor. He got some of the most harrowing stuff I've ever heard in my life. I never want to hear it again. I can actually still hear it sometimes on a bad day. A lot of it we couldn't broadcast. It was just awful. But we got the story. We did the job. We told it as it was. That, I think, is what made Radio 1 Newsbeat. Plus, we had great stringers. Caroline and I did what became risibly known as the honeymoon tour of England, because they sent the two of us off round all radio... We went round all the local radio stations in Britain, literally all of them at the time. Wasn't as many as there are now. We picked up Richard Skinner from Radio Solent. He became one of the presenters on the programme. Laurie Mayer came across from Radio London and did Newsbeat. We had Ed Stewart.
And on the Tea Time Newsbeat, we'll be meeting the young wife who's been named as Britain's champion booty maker.
We had, because of our... We'd made the contact with the local radio stations. We had a great team of stringers. And we encouraged them. We said, look, if you've got a story, tell us. Because it may not be Radio 4, but it may well be Radio 1. And we got some very, very good material as a result of that. After the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, when I found myself, for reasons I won't bore you with, on top of a loudspeaker van talking to 50,000 people immediately after Tariq Ali, who was a Workers' Revolutionary Party or whatever, student revolutionary at the time, they made the mistake of giving me the microphone, so I took it. And I went away and I thought, well, if it's all very well, but if you really believe this, you've got to do something about it. So I joined the Conservative Party and became an activist. Then I decided that time had come to try to get into Parliament. And of course, I was boxed in completely because I was working for Current Affairs. And at that time, in BBC Current Affairs Group, or News, you weren't allowed to be party political, or political, really. Whisper it softly, unless, of course, you were Labour. But Dick Tracy, who became a Member of Parliament, and I, who were about the only two Tories in the BBC at the time, well, Caroline Schindler as well, were ostracised, almost. I was hauled in before the Director General. Because I had dared, in my own time and unpaid, to go and give a talk about broadcasting to young would-be Tory candidates a training centre in Yorkshire. I got hauled down to the Director General's office and, what the hell do you think you're doing? So it's my own time. Well, how much were you paid? I wasn't paid. I'm a Tory. And so was he. I mean, Ted Heath was godfather to the man's son. The other thing I did wrong was during that election, I got Ted Heath on radio. On Radio 1, I was the first... Whether I did him any favours or not is a moot point, but I got all three party leaders. And the reason I was able to do that was because of internal contact. I rang up William Waldegrave and said, who was a young, shining Tory and part of Ted's team, and said, can we have Ted on Radio 1? Can I get some kids to interview him? And they bit at the idea, and then it was easy to get Harold and Jeremy Thorpe, which we did.
You, of course, have made up your own mind, presumably, in your own personal opinion, which you will be putting to the Cabinet. What is that opinion?
I think I will put it in the Cabinet before I put it anywhere else.
Today programme. Mike Cheney went down from Newsbeat, became the editor-in-chief of the Today programme, and asked me if I'd go and join him from Newsbeat, so I did. So I became a duty editor on the Today programme for a bit. Brian Redhead, John Timpson. Again, you know, you learn a lot from people like that. Wonderfully experienced. And I did some stuff on The World Tonight. Jerry Priestland, the tallest elf in Broadcasting House, who was a Methodist, I think, minister. You learn lessons from these people. I slugged a story once, the world's worst air crash. It's the only time I've ever known Jerry Priestland get remotely anything like angry. He was such a mild-mannered, gentle man, and impeccably courteous. He said, you can't say that. This is a jumbo jet that had fallen out of the sky, you know, with... Heaven knows how many people on board. I said, Jerry, it is. He said, no, Roger. The world's worst air crash is the one in which somebody you know dies. And I learnt from that. And when the Twin Towers happened, years, years, years later, when I had to attend a church service in my constituency, the church was absolutely packed, and I was asked to speak. And I'm not a preacher. I don't do sermons. It was a very raw, difficult morning. And I went back to Jerry Priestland and I said to the congregation, we all need to remember, this is not the world's worst terrorist disaster or the one in which hundreds of people died. It's the disaster in which hundreds of individuals who were heads of families or mothers or brothers or sisters or whatever died. We need to get it into that context. And I owe that to Jerry, because if he hadn't taught me that lesson, I wouldn't have learnt it. One of the things you find out in current affairs broadcasting is that so long as you're getting the same number of complaints from left and right, and that was true of Radio 1 Newsbeat and it's true of the Today programme, you can reckon you're probably getting the pitch about right. I would argue, well, I would, wouldn't I, that the Today programme has become more socialist than it was. Whether that's fair criticism or not, I don't know. I notice the bits that are antagonistic towards my tribe, but then my dear friends on the Labour benches, and people are always surprised to know that we do actually have very good friends on the opposition benches, they will all say, yeah, but what about us? And they're treated badly, so it goes with the territory. I wasn't there for very long because I went to see Geoffrey Johnson Smith, who was a consummate broadcaster himself, of course. He came from the Cliff Mitchell Moore Tonight programme and made his name there. Well, Old Smoothie, as he was known, then became the Member of Parliament for Wealden and the Vice Chairman of the Conservative Party with responsibility for candidates. And I went to see Geoffrey about getting onto the candidates list with a view to becoming a Conservative Member of Parliament. And Geoffrey said, look, party's not ready for an actor. So if you're serious, you're going to have to go and find yourself another job, which was partly what took me into radio in the first place. But then I did the same thing again with Marcus Fox to get onto the candidates list. And they said, look, you can't do this and be a current affairs broadcaster. So there was a new programme starting on children's television, and there was a six-month attachment from anywhere, actually, within the BBC to children's television to do this new programme called Multicoloured Swap Shop. And one of the things that had haunted me right the way through was my pirate radio days and Oh You Know About Pop Music. Now, we've already discussed the fact that I knew very little, actually, about pop music compared with anybody who really knew the subject, like Paul Gambaccini or Tony Blackburn or whoever. But I knew about pop music, so I did pop music for Newsbeat, along with Richard Skinner, of course. But then I was asked to do the music, to set up the music for Multicoloured Swap Shop. So I went across and I did that.
Oh, yes. Hello. A very good morning to you. I was just reading one of the morning papers. In fact, we'll go back to that paper.
Then I had a decision to make, because I was told your attachment's ending. Swap Shop was only supposed to run for, I think, 6 episodes, ran for 12 throughout the winter. They then decided it was so successful they wanted to do a second series, and they wanted to keep the same team. And I had to make the decision, and my job was on the line. Did I stay with Swap Shop, or did I go back to Radio 4? Because of the political interest, I decided that the best thing to do was stay in children's television, which I did. So I did Multicoloured Swap Shop as a production assistant. I did Horses Galore as a production assistant. I did John Craven's News Round as a production assistant. I did a bit of directing, but mainly production assistant on Blue Peter. I wanted to make a teenage magazine programme, and nobody in the BBC would bite at it anywhere. I tried the regions, I tried everybody. Everybody said, there is no demand for a teenage magazine programme. I took it to a guy called John Hambley, who was the head of children's television at Thames Television. And John said, OK, come and make it. And terrible thing happened, because Mike Cheney had then gone off to become the station manager, editor, manager, of the new BBC Radio Norfolk. Lovely place to live with a young family, and he wanted me as his number two. And he'd fought the establishment at the BBC, who said, but he's now a television person, and this is a local radio promotion, and we want somebody from local radio, and he's no longer local radio, even though it started in local radio. Bless him, Mike fought the battle and won it. And the BBC announced, without telling me, that I'd been appointed as the assistant station manager for BBC Radio Norfolk on the same day that I'd accepted the job with Thames Television. And I had to say, I'm terribly sorry. I've signed a contract. I don't renege. I've made my bed. I've got to lie on it. And I wasn't popular, because they had to then reboard the whole thing all over again. And Mike, bless him, actually, was very good about it, because he understood that they'd messed me around. I didn't know you know, I had to earn a living and I didn't know where I was going to go.
Hello, this is Radio Norfolk, your new neighbour, broadcasting on...
So I went off to Thames Television, made a programme called White Light, which was even before Janet Street Porter, it was the first teenage magazine, which got that nomination. We didn't win it, but we got a BAFTA nomination.
Whole of the series, we've been talking about the fact that people can't go and see the films they want to see, they can't drink in the pubs they want to drink, etc., etc. What can your parties do to actually...
Well, I made two or three programmes for Thames, then fought a by-election in Birmingham Northfield. Well, losing wasn't fun. I lost Birmingham Northfield by 279 votes. Jocelyn Cadbury, bless him, blew his brains out. He was a Conservative Member of Parliament. He won the seat. Was never supposed to win it. It was a Labour seat, but he won it by, I think, 221 votes or something. I lost it by 279, that I do remember. Went to two recounts. I was furious. I really wanted to win. I hated losing. Hal Miller, who was my minder, who was a senior Conservative Member of Parliament, said, son, it's the best thing that could ever have happened to you. I practically killed him. I was furious. He was right, of course, because I wouldn't be in the House now if I'd won Northfield at that by-election. John Speller won it. A guy called Roger King, they changed the boundaries slightly, and Roger came in behind me and won it for the Tories, to Parliament.
Good evening and welcome to our election results programme. From now until 4 a.m, we'll be bringing you the fastest service of results and comment from the...
They then changed the boundaries again, elections, and Roger lost it. I got North Thanet, 1983, and I've been there ever since. I don't regret it, although, given the present climate, I'm not sure I'd do it again. I drove up to the carriage gates on the Monday morning after the election and, clutching my writ, which is on the wall of this office, and said, I'm a Member of Parliament. And the policeman said, yes, sir, we've got 650 of those here. Could I see your ID? I came in. You get a key to your locker to keep your football boots and your sandwiches in. Almost literally. I've still got the key somewhere. I've never used the locker. And then you start. There's no brief for the job. I was a young man with then, or youngish man, I was 40, rising 40, I wasn't even quite 40, with a daughter, teenage, difficult daughter, stroppy elder son, and a 2-year-old baby. And a wife who gave up her perfectly good job and came to work with me to run my office and be my secretary and do my diary, and she was the only member of staff I had for a long time. It was the only one we could afford. I took a 3/4 cut in income to become a Member of Parliament. Susie took, I think, a 50% cut in income to come and work for me. We remortgaged 5 times. God knows how we survived. We had kids being educated, we had bills to pay, and bought a house in the constituency, because we promised we would, and sold a house in London, which would now be worth an absolute, well, is, I know, worth an absolute fortune if we'd hung on to it, but we couldn't. But nobody made us do it. Susie and I decided that's what we were going to do. I couldn't have and wouldn't have done it without her. And here we are.
It is not possible to redefine marriage.
Here, here.
Marriage is the union between a man...
I've always sat right at the back. Very deliberately.
Has been historically remains.
Because you can dominate the whole house from the back. It's like an amphitheatre. If you're down in the front, you're speaking up. You can survey everything from up on, literally on the back benches. I think the ability to project, the ability to hold an audience, the ability to dominate a theatre, which is what this is, helps. If you've got a reasonable voice, and of course you're for theatre, particularly for Shakespearean theatre, you're taught to project. So that's not a problem. The people, I think, who come off best in terms of oratory and presentation, sparing my own case, are actors, people with media experience generally, and, of course, barristers, who are probably the best of the lot because they have the ability to marshal arguments and thoughts because they have to, because that's their stock in trade, and the ability to present them, and the ability to speak in public. So they're probably best. And then, of course, for a long time, I was on various select committees dealing with broadcasting. I was one of the original opponents of the televising of the House. I made the final speech. Jack Weatherall, the Speaker of the House, in his book, said mine was one of 10 speeches that he considered had changed the course of a debate. Why? Well, one, because I knew what I was talking about, and two, because I spoke last when the house was full. If I'd done it mid-afternoon, it wouldn't have influenced anybody at all, but I got lucky with the timing, so I don't think that was anything to do with me, other than that I knew what I was talking about. So when I said, they're going to take over this place, this is not about democracy, it's about sexing up the news at 9 and the news at 10. They're going to take the bits they want to use. It's going to mean that because television rewards outrageousness, that the person who is the most extreme will get the coverage, so it's going to change the nature of the place. It has.
And we not only saved the world, saved the banks, and saved the banks and led the way. We not only saved the banks.
And I still maintain that it hasn't done us any favours at all. Although there is now, of course, at least the Parliament Channel, so people can see everything. But that doesn't alter the fact that what most people see is Prime Minister's Question Time. Do they all behave like that? No, of course they don't. They only behave like that at Prime Minister's Question Time. But that's the impression of Parliament that a lot of people get. Or they see the clip taken from the floor of the House from somebody saying something controversial or outrageous or whatever, or politically incorrect, which is used on the news. And that's clipped and taken out of context. But it was ever thus. I have my own, what is called an ISDN line, my own broadcasting quality line. I've got the only one in the house. I've got my own mixing box, so I can do a broadcast quality interview from here in my office at the House of Commons to anywhere in the world. And I've got a similar line in my home, so I carry the box backwards and forwards, and I can do that anywhere. And I always try and do live broadcasting if I possibly can, because at least then some people can hear what I actually said rather than the clip that somebody's lifted out because it justifies the story they're trying to make.
Well, joining us now, the Thanet North MP, Sir Roger Gale, and the leader of Kent County Council, Paul Carter. Roger, good morning to you. If I could start with you, just explain to us...
Well, I do quite a lot of it. Okay, only local radio, mainly, occasionally. I'm allowed to do Radio 4 if I'm saying something that they consider to be sufficiently politically antagonistic to the Conservative Party to allow me on. But that aside, you know, I'm old enough now to not want to change my views and to be not afraid to express them. I don't think I ever have, actually. I've always said what I think. But I do quite a lot of it. I do enough of it to keep my hand in, as it were. And I enjoy doing it. I think, by and large, British radio is still the least worst in the world. And I think it is of a high standard, generally. I think Radio 5 has been refreshing and has done a lot for, in a Newsbeat sort of way, if you like, has done a lot for sound broadcasting, news, current affairs, sport broadcasting generally. I think the quality of a lot of Radio 4 material is very good indeed, as is World Service. People tend to forget World Service because most people don't hear it. But that's of a very high standard. I worry because BBC local radio particularly has always been a training ground for young journalists. There's always been an opportunity. And up until fairly recently, although Tony Hall has indicated he's going to put more money back into local radio, but certainly up until Tony Hall, local radio was facing awful cutbacks while television was squandering money, and still does, on hospitality and taxis and all sorts of things. The amount of money that network television wastes is phenomenal. License fee money. Some of that money put into local radio should allow the training ground to be re-established, as we need tomorrow's broadcasters. And I freely concede, I mean, I'm a dinosaur. Yeah, I'm a razor blade and editing block man. Show me a digital editing suite, and I don't begin to know how to operate it. We need those kids with crusty old editors, the Vin Bootles, the Mike Cheneys of this world, who are prepared to kick ass and know what they want and get what they want and teach people the hard way without being too politically correct. And that's a danger, because if you're going to do it, you have to be brave. You have to be prepared to challenge the establishment, whatever the establishment is. And how do you learn that? Well, you learn it from good, crusty editors on local radio stations teaching kids how to go on to network and encouraging them to do so. And that's where I've been, again, very lucky. They were generous professionally. They wanted you to succeed. They wanted you to move on. They recognised, you know, that you've got your wings. Oh, there's no point having regrets. You can always look back and say things ain't what they used to be. Well, they aren't. This place, House of Commons, isn't what it used to be. But it's different. And somebody much brighter than me, when I was whining and saying, you know, this place has changed, it's not what it used to be, nobody's going to want to come here. And, you know, I wouldn't advise my children to come into the House of Commons today. And somebody said to me, look, when you came in, it wasn't like it was in the 1930s. A young man or woman coming in today is going to see it as it is, not as you knew it 30 years ago. And of course they're right. And they'll see it and do it and take it and make of it what they can and what they will. Fondly by my grandchildren. And in the hope that we've done as much damage limitation in the time that we've had as we've been able to. That's not a tremendous epitaph, but it's probably about as good as anybody can ask for in this game.